The following message is by Dr. Jason DeRoshi, Research Professor of Old Testament and Biblical Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Content Developer and Global Trainer with Hands to the Plow Ministries. You can find more from Dr. DeRoshi at www.jasonderoshi.com.
Welcome, brothers and sisters. Let's turn our attention to the book of Samuel. The God who protects, blesses, and assesses. This is a book about honoring the Lord. Those who honor me, I will honor. God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Those who honor me, this is the word for glory. Do you live for the glory of God? It's the exact same word. It means to give weight to. And this is a book about the weightiness of God and his call to recognize and celebrate that weightiness. And in the early chapters, there's many plays on words that we often miss in our English text, related directly to kavod or kaveh, these words for weighty or weightiness, honor, glory, glorious. Because Eli's family honors themselves rather than honoring God. And in doing so, they're getting weighty, that is, fat, on the sacrifices that were not theirs to eat. And the result is their death. And then we're told, no glory. Ichabod. No glory. It's departed from Israel, and it's seen in the lives of the priests. So building off the evident need for a king at the end of Judges, Samuel enters in and outlines the rise of kingship. It stresses the Davidic kingdom hope. It clarifies the importance of honoring the Lord above all else, something that's extremely important for the king. But this principle found in 1 Samuel 2:30, those who honor me, I will honor, those who despise me will be lightly esteemed, it just carries on through the entire narrative of Samuel, so that you might be a barren woman who honors the Lord, and he will elevate you. But you might be a priest who dishonors the Lord, and he will bring you down. You might be a king who dishonors the Lord, and he'll take away your throne. You might be a giant who is haughty, cursing against God and against his people. He will bring you down. But you could also be a shepherd boy that God will raise up in the context of those who honor him, he will honor. So we've got Samuel's growth and the hope for a king priest, Saul's rise and demise and the hope for a king priest. That is Saul's failure and rejection, David's rise and demise, and the hope for a king priest. And then, at the end of the book, a stamp that David was not the king priest. His entire life and his hope pointed toward this coming messianic king priest. So the book is going to trace Samuel's growth, Saul's appointment failure and rejection, David's rise and fall as king, all in order to ultimately anticipate a king priest. Does Samuel anticipate this king priest? Yes, he does. And if you look carefully in the book of Chronicles, you'll find out he actually is a Levite. One of you thought he was not. He's actually in the tribe of Levi, and he is a legitimate priest. And then the question is, well, what about David? He's definitely not in the tribe of Levi. Why is he doing priestly things? His life is going to anticipate the ultimate king priest. Saul, as a foil for David, also represents the king priest in a contrastive way. He does what he should not do. And God had said the ultimate king would rise from the tribe of Judah, not the tribe of Benjamin. And Benjamin is the bad place. That's the place at the end of the book of Judges where we saw all the worthless men, they're called. Eli's sons are then called worthless men in chapter 2, connecting them with the Benjamite city of Gibeah. And Saul is from there. That's where Saul's from. And so it should be a signal to us, having read Judges, wait, Saul the king, he's from Benjamin? In Gibeah? Gibeah of Saul? This isn't good. He's been surrounded by debauchery. What does this mean about him? And it should be a signal for us. We're going to meet Saul for the first time hunting an ass. I think that's intentional. Where do we meet David for the first time? Shepherding sheep. There is a literary contrast going on here between these two figures that is highly intentional. Shepherd is a royal image all throughout the ancient world. And David fits the bill. There's only three people in the entire Bible whose height is ever mentioned, and they're all in this book. Consider who they are and the implications as we move into the book of Samuel and read the words that are used. So, kingdom, we're in the K-I-N-G, we're in G, government in the land, and now we're moving after conquest into kingdoms proper. The united, and then in kings, we're going to see divided. So today is united kingdom, focused on the rise of Saul, and then his rejection, and then the rise of David. So former anticipations of kingship. This book is going to give us a king. And I just want to hear from you. I know on my handout I gave you a list of passages, but I didn't give you what's in those passages. So tell me, you try to think back, what anticipations have we already had that Israel would one day have a king? And it's framed in the context of deliverance. So we read that refrain four times at the end of the book, culminating in the very last verse, Judges 21:25, there was no king in the land. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So that leads us in. I want you to recognize that in Jesus' Bible, Judges leaves Israel at the very bottom. And even though Ruth, because of its historical placement, in the days that the judges judged, is how the book of Ruth opens, it connects it chronologically with the book of Judges, this is not where in Jesus' Bible Ruth showed up. Instead, it lets you feel the weightiness of the book of Judges, and that carries us in to the book of Samuel. And right at the beginning of Samuel, we read, there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuth, an Ephrathite. He had two wives. Right off the bat, there's a signal. He has two wives. There's improper family structure here. This is not how it was at the beginning. There's only two reasons that we see apparent throughout Scripture and outside the Bible where polygamy was practiced. One, the barrenness of a wife. Two, in order to establish your political relationship with kings around you. So you would marry the daughters of kings and establish political peace. The Bible identifies that step of marriage alliances is a lack of trust in God. And therefore, the king in Deuteronomy 17, we're told, don't do it. Every single instance of polygamy due to barrenness throughout Scripture, we see them filled up in the book of Genesis. But a number of other instances, including in Samuel, in every instance, it's never portrayed as a good thing. And I think it's a signal right off the front of this book that you've got unhealthy family. They're growing up in the age of the judges. That is the age of the curse. The very fact that she is barren, Deuteronomy 7 says, shouldn't have happened. Hannah was the first wife. Peninnah is the second wife. And Peninnah is there because Hannah is barren. And that's a signal, not that there's a problem with Hannah per se, but that there's a problem in the land so that this woman is barren. It's a sign of curse in Israel. Just like Israel was never supposed to lose a battle, so too, perfect obedience would have resulted in open, productive wombs. And reading this history of the covenant, in light of the covenant, you've got to be aware when you see she's barren and there's two wives here, that's a signal something's wrong in Israel. And that's exactly where we left off with the book of Judges. Yes, there's something wrong in Israel. We just had it depicted to us. But not only was there an unhealthy family, he had two wives. The one was Hannah. The other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children. Hannah had none. Now, this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests before the Lord. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all of her daughters. But to Hannah, he gave either a portion of anger, or, as the ESV says, a double portion. Because he loved Hannah, but the Lord had closed her womb. He would go up year by year to Shiloh. And later we're going to learn it's an annual journey. But that's not what Deuteronomy said was supposed to happen. Three times a year they're supposed to go up to the central sanctuary. Not just one. And it seems to me this is our second clue. Not only is there unhealthy family, there is unhealthy corporate worship. And both of these are a signal to us, yes, there's a problem. Israel's under a curse, in deep need. This is how we're introduced into the book of Samuel. So Judges 21:25, definitely. Other texts, even way before Judges, that anticipate a king. Anybody? The Proto-Evangelion. So the first gospel. Where is that? Genesis 3:15. So that anticipation that an individual would rise who'd be strong enough to do what no other man on earth had been able to do, that is overcome the serpent's temptation. He would be a warrior who would enter into battle head to head with the serpent. Other texts. Okay, Deuteronomy 17 is the clearest text, and we're going to have to go to that text today because in it, well, let me just say this. If I was to ask you, what was the problem with Israel asking for a king in 1 Samuel 8? Anybody? Over on the right-hand side, we hear they wanted a king like the nations. But how does Deuteronomy 17 begin? Deuteronomy 17:14, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you and you possess it and dwell in it, and then you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you. So long as he looks this way and acts this way. So was the problem that they wanted a king like all the other nations? Is that really the problem? Was the problem that the other nations had a king and now Israel wants a human king? Or was the problem that Israel wanted a king like the nations viewed a king? And we're going to see, I think, that's what's at stake. Because it doesn't say they wanted a king like the nations in 1 Samuel 8. Go to 1 Samuel 8 and look carefully. How is it worded? What did they want? Okay. It says that at the end of the chapter, they wanted a king to go out before them to fight their battles. How's it worded at the beginning of the chapter? They want, this is the difference with Deuteronomy 17. They don't just want a king like all the nations. The nations have a king, we want a king. That would be fine. They want a king to judge them like the nations have a king. Which means by nature, they don't want Samuel to be the judge. And they don't want ultimately Yahweh to be the judge. Who's the one who fights for them? And that's why God is going to say, they're wanting to replace me. And Deuteronomy 17 is the foundational text that not only tells us when Israel gets in the land, they're going to have a king, but it details what that king needs to look like. And Saul is just the opposite. Once again, the covenant is becoming the lens for how to read the history of the covenant. And we're going to see that Samuel envisions Saul to be the exact opposite of what is called for in Deuteronomy 17. Ultimately, David, when he passes the baton in 1 Kings chapter 2, the baton of the reign over to Solomon, he's going to include in it a scroll. And in that scroll will be the very word of God. And in Deuteronomy 17, the specifics that were given were that the king is to have his own copy of this law, confirmed by the Levitical priests. And he is to not just have it on his person, but he's supposed to read from it every single day so that his heart will not grow haughty above his brothers, and so that he might fear the Lord and obey the Lord. That is, Israel's king is not supposed to replace Yahweh. He's supposed to represent Yahweh always. He is a man of the book, a man under authority, a man of the word. He's not the highest in the land. He simply points to the one who's highest in the land. And Saul is not that. So Deuteronomy is massively significant. Genesis 15 already laid out that it would be a 400-year distance. So that's part of what's anticipated. And the fact that it's taken them 40 years to get to the border at the beginning of Joshua, what should have taken 11 days, says Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 2. They should have already been in, should have in the sense of from God's revealed will and his calling of the 12 spies, they should have already been in there. It's taken them a few extra centuries of tribal confederacy working through all the judges era. That recurring motif, there was no king in the land, there was no king in the land, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That could be a hint that you're in the land, you should have already set this up. That's possible. But when we read 1 Samuel chapter 8, it does seem as though the problem is that they want a king to replace the Lord and not represent the Lord. They don't like living under Yahweh, the majority. Any other texts that you want to add into future anticipations, former anticipations? All the way in the back. Bingo. Great. So Genesis 49, 8 through 10, where it just becomes explicit. The scepter will not depart from Judah. This king who's going to come, this deliverer that's anticipated to overcome the evil one, an offspring of the woman, an offspring of Abraham, will also be an offspring of Judah. So that's a signal. And so even in the appointment of Saul, it should be explicit to a reader who's familiar with the Bible, he's not the one. He is not the ultimate deliverer. Great, great. There are others. That's enough for now. Let's move into this book. So we have Hannah, who is barren, and we have a nearly blind high priest. It seems to me that his lack of sight is parabolic of his soul, intentionally so in the beginning of this book, just as his weight is going to be parabolic of his soul. He's more concerned about his own weightiness, his own glory, than he is the glory of God. But so too, in pushing aside that which is truly beautiful and embracing that which is empty, his eyes have become dull. His ears have become weak. So that as the very high priest who's supposed to be the one encountering and representing, reflecting, resembling the living God in the presence of the people, in chapter 3, Samuel, and Eli's not going to have a clue. That's why I think it's repeated over and over again, to emphasize the high priest doesn't know the voice of God. But God's going to raise up one who does. So, Hannah senses her own neediness in the midst of her brokenness, and she does what is right. In the midst of experiencing the curse, when you taste and see Genesis 3, you reach back for Genesis 2, pleading with God to free you from the bondage. You're my only answer. I am broken. You're the healer. That's what Hannah does. She prays to God. And he answers her. And in the midst of that answer, he opens her womb, and she cries out to God. And it's in her song that we get a fundamental lens for understanding the rest of the book. So let's just look at it. Chapter 2, verse 1. My heart exalts in Yahweh. My strength is exalted in Yahweh. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like Yahweh. We heard something similar in the middle of Exodus 15. Now we're getting the declaration through the mouth of a prophetess. Holy, holy is the Lord. And that holiness, when you encounter it, it demands that we rightly embrace it as for the weight that it is. The visible manifestation of God's holiness is glory. It is God's holiness gone public. That's what glory is. And for us to glorify something is to recognize its weightiness, recognize its gloriousness. Now, one of my daughters, when she was young, got a little doggie. It was a stuffed doggie named Scooter. I can't tell you how thrilled she was moving to Kansas City and to find out there was a Scooter's right across the street. This dog has been with her most of her life. And when she was younger, this dog went with her wherever her life went. She treasures this dog, and it has lost all of its beans. And yet, she still loves this dog, and it means something to her. She glorifies that dog. That's what it is. She holds that dog as having a weighty place. Not every meal that I go through the cafeteria am I instilled to give that meal glory. But there are some, like last night, I really like Chinese. And they gave me a good amount of white rice and then a good amount of this sesame sweet and sour chicken stuff. And every single bite was delightful. Every single bite. And in fact, when I got to the end, and I was in the middle of a meeting when I was eating, I really wanted to get up and leave the meeting and go get a second plate, but I withheld. It's hard for me to beat Chipotle. I mean, I just, of any quick food place, take me to Chipotle. And I don't get the burrito anymore, because if I get the burrito bowl with the tortillas on the side, I get more. So I go through and I want the white rice and the black beans and the greens. And I used to just say the hot sauce, but now I found out the green sauce, that too is really, really good. So I want the hot and the green and the corn and the cheese. And I've been jogging, so I've been holding off on the sour cream, but it still tastes so good. And then I bring it to my plate and I sit down, and many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's just good. All those flavors together are just right. What am I doing? I'm glorifying Chipotle. I know how to do this. You know how to do this. My wife and I have been married 26 years. That's probably about 350 walks times 26 that I've gotten to take with my girl. She is hands down my best friend and the greatest human helper on the planet that God has ever blessed me with. And to top it off, I think she's really cute. She is a treasure to me. She has made me a better minister in this classroom. She confronts me in my sin. She supports me in my academic pursuits. And boy, does she treasure our kids. It was a big deal when my daughter, that we had homeschooled from kindergarten, made it into college. It's like, you go, girl. Yes, I'm cheering my daughter on, but my wife, she got these kids through school. Unbelievable. It's awesome. I glory in my wife. She is a treasure that I praise the Lord for. One of the things that my family deeply missed this summer was the Olympics. Lord willing, they'll come back next year. But for 26 years, my wife and I, every 2 years, winter, summer, we just delight in seeing men and women do things with their bodies that I have never been able to do. One time in my life, I had muscles. I was a Mason's tender the first year of marriage. After that, there's nothing left. But to see these bodies working with such unbelievable care and agility and strength and stamina and perseverance. Last night, just because I could, along with my sesame chicken, I had pumpkin pie. But I was thinking this morning about the fact that there were a number of those athletes that have already said it's been 2 full years since I had dessert, and now they delayed the Olympics, which means I can't have dessert for another 365 days. Zero. Nothing but water for me. That type of drive is, at one level, glorious. And yet I remember sitting in Twin Stadium at the very highest, we were like second from the highest row, took my son to the baseball game in Minneapolis, and just sitting there feeling the weightiness of this massive sea of idolatry. Because rather than encountering glory and raising it up one octave to the point of praise, people were just leaving it at that level and just glorifying in the people and idolizing the strength of the players and the teams, and it's not where it should be. But brothers and sisters, this book is about glory. It's about honor. And I just want to say right up front, you know what that means. And God says, those who honor me, I will honor. Romans chapter 2, how is it worded right off the front? To him who seeks glory and honor and immortality, I will give eternal life. To have it as part of your quest. But to him who is self-seeking and does not obey the truth, but obeys unrighteousness, there will be wrath and fury. Those who honor me, I will honor. Those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. Whatever you do, whether you eat, whether you drink, do it all for the glory of God. Why did Jesus need to come? Because we had fallen short of his glory. This book is about glory. And Hannah saw it. In God's opening her womb, she saw the holy God, and it erupted praise in her soul. Holy are you, O God. There is no one holy like you, no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. And then she says this. You can't see it in my ESV. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. So she's addressing Peninnah here, who was taunting her. But very literally, the Hebrew says, talk no more, declaring high, high. That is elevated, elevated. And it's been rendered as proud. But it's that word, high, high, that's then repeated three times in this book in relation to three different characters, all of whom are a foil to David. Who's the first one that we're told is high? Anybody? Saul. The height of his stature was a head above all of his peers. Who's the second person we're told is high? He's the third. Who's the second? I just heard it. Eliab, David's oldest brother. So the chapter begins in 1 Samuel 16 that God rejected Saul. And then we read, God has not chosen him. God has not chosen him. God has not chosen him. Eliab wasn't the one, but what made Samuel think that he was the one was the height of his stature. And God says, man doesn't look at the outward face. God does not look at the outward face. Man does. The outward appearance. Where does God look? At the heart. But Eliab's height is a contrast then to David's heart. And then the last one is Goliath. And Eliab's going to show up in that very story against Goliath again. We'll see that shortly. So stop being high. Because those who are high, God can bring down. That's one of the motifs in this book. And it's related to those who honor me, I will honor. As she continues to say, verse 4 of chapter 2, the bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who are full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who are hungry have ceased to be hungry. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. Yahweh kills and Yahweh brings to life. That's Deuteronomy 32, 39. There is no God besides me. I kill and I bring to life. I wound and I am the one who heals. Hannah has experienced it out of the deadness of her cursed state. God has brought blessing. New creation has been erupted in her own soul. She's experienced the power of the living God. The very one who said, let light shine out of darkness, has now shone into her heart and given the light of the gospel. Good news, hope, the holy God reigns, and he's for me and not against me. Verse 7, Yahweh makes poor, and he's the one who makes rich. He brings low, and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts up the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. Oh, yes, the pillars of the earth are Yahweh's. Everything is upheld by his hand. But not by might shall man prevail. The adversaries of Yahweh shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. Yahweh will judge the ends of the earth. He'll give strength to his king. And right there, there's an intrusion of remarkable hope. And then it ends, he'll exalt the power of his anointed. This is the first time in all the Bible where this anticipated coming king is also called the Messiah, the anointed one. First time. A royal figure is designated anointed. Up to this point, only the priests have been considered anointed figures. But now Hannah declares the Messiah is coming. Yes, there is no king in Israel. Everyone does what is right in their own eyes, but the Messiah is coming. The royal king is coming. And God uses this woman who's just experienced new creational hope to erupt in this prophetic prediction. Well, as you know, Samuel is born, and he's growing up. He's placed at the central sanctuary. It's not in Jerusalem yet. He's placed at the central sanctuary in Shiloh, where there's a corrupt priesthood. Eli and his two sons. Not only are the two sons who are supposed to be facilitating proper worship eating food that God didn't designate for them. The priests have lots of food. The sin offering, the guilt offering, that's the priestly meal. But the fellowship offering that the people bring is supposed to be eaten by the people themselves. God's invited them into his presence, and this is the food he's provided at their table. But the priests are coming in with their own fork, just going into the boiling pot and pulling out what they will. Food that the King of Kings designated to be enjoyed in his presence by one of his worshipers is just being claimed by the priests. That's God's food, and they're taking it. Not too smart. But not only that, the female servants that are at the tabernacle are being abused by these priests. They're sleeping with them. In the very context of holy, holy, holy is the Lord, they're corrupting the sanctuary. And what we're told is Eli goes to them and says, verse 24, "No, my sons, this is not a good report that I hear. If someone sins against man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death." So he didn't overcome their rebellion. They stayed cold of heart. Now it might seem, oh, Eli's done all that he can. But Eli's not in a good state himself. It mentions, oh yes, he said to them, "Stop it, boys." But he didn't have the tenacity to take on the role that he should have and stop them from such corruption in the presence of the holy God. Now, the fact that it says God desired to put them to death, we haven't seen a statement so forthright for many books, but we have seen something very similar in the past. Who can remember? Where did we see it? Where the sovereign God gave us a clue that his goal in withholding, not overcoming resistance, indeed, even in hardening, was the destruction of a certain person, Pharaoh. And why did we learn in the book of Exodus that he would do such a thing? What was the ultimate end? His own glory. to make much of himself as a God who can hate sin, a God who can treasure his own holiness. So just for me as a reader, even if I didn't know where the rest of the story was going, it at least, the fact that I saw it happen in the book of Exodus should, for me as a reader, ignite something to say, huh, why would God do that? That's a good question. It's a very hard verse. When we read, they did not repent because God desired to put them to death. But we at least have to step back and say, okay, God's a big God. This must have something to do with his glory. Because all that he does is from him, through him, and for him. So is this book going to tell me how this relates to his glory? And oh, yes, it will. Now, I said that Eli was not off the map. Oh, yes, he went and said, boys, you really shouldn't be doing this. But then we read this. A man of God came to Eli, verse 27 of chapter 2. Did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt? Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest? Verse 29, why then do you scorn my sacrifices? He's talking to Eli. You scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded. You honor your sons above me by fattening. What does it say? Yourselves. See, you've got a hypocritical dad here, boys. You really shouldn't be pulling that meat out. Do you have a rib? You really shouldn't be stabbing that. Boy, I'd really love a big piece of that rump. He's among the very ones who are getting fattened on the very food that God had designated for the worshipers. His words meant nothing because he wanted to delight in the sin like them. And so it says that they were not honoring God, rather that he was honoring, give weight to, glorifying his sons more than glorifying God. And the evidence was they were all getting fat, physically fat. On sin. Therefore, Yahweh, the God of Israel, said, I promise that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. That is, in perpetuity, no end in sight. The word is olam, and it's built off the Hebrew verb alam, which means to be hidden. So, in English, it really is, I don't know if we have any other word that could work. So we render it forever, but things that are forever are not necessarily forever. There can be built-in contingencies. What the word itself means is out there in a way that is hidden. We can't see the end. But it doesn't mean that God can't see the end. So there's certain things that are declared to be forever in the Bible that are merely the end is hidden from us, meaning that it's distant, it's out there. And whether it's actually forever is somewhat going to be unpacked for us in the narrative. God promised that his house would go in and out before the Lord forever, but now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, but those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. It's a theme verse that was already shown to be true in Hannah's words. Now, not only that, God declares the destruction of the Eli house, and then we get down to verse 35. I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who stands in contrast to the unfaithful ones that Samuel's going to have to grow up with. This faithful priest will do according to what is in my heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house. And then my ESV says, he shall go in and out before my anointed forever. Who's the anointed? According to chapter 2, verse 10. God's king. So the way my ESV reads, it's as if there's two people that are promised, an anointed king and a faithful priest. Can you see that? I don't think that's how it is. I think there's actually one anointed figure, and it's the king priest. How do I get there? Look at the end of verse 35. I will build him a sure house. It's a masculine noun. In Hebrew, there's no neuter. In English, we have neuter pronouns, not in Hebrew. So it's masculine noun, house. And then it's followed by a third masculine singular pronoun. It's either it or it's he. Now consider what it would mean if it was it. And the house in context is the nearest referent to identify what the pronoun means. I will build him a sure house, and it shall go in and out before my anointed, namely the priest, namely the king, forever. The house will go in and out. That is, those identified with this king priest will be moving in and out of his presence over and over continually. Now, support for that reading, I think that's the proper reading, just look up at verse 30, where God said, your house and your and the house of your father will go in and out before me. It's the house that goes in and out before the presence of God. And now the house of the new priest will go in and out before the anointed. That is the priest king. I think this book is not anticipating two figures. This book is anticipating a single figure, a figure that will be, that's going, his priesthood is going to replace the Eliad priesthood, that is the Levitical priesthood. It's going to replace it. And it's not going to be fulfilled in the person of Zadok in the days of David. It's going to be fulfilled, I believe, in the person of the Psalm 110 priest king. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. He is a king at the right hand of God, in the sitting on the throne of God. And then he says, you are my priest in the order of Melchizedek. He is king and he's priest. I think this book is bringing together the anointed figure of 210 with the anointed priest of 235 and identifying, we're anticipating a single figure, a priest king. And Samuel as priest, but not king, is going to, his life is going to anticipate this future priest. David's life as king, doing priestly things, like even offering sacrifices and building altars and wanting to build a temple, is going to be doing, this king is going to be doing priestly things, but we're going to find out he's not the one either. And both of their lives point to one greater than themselves. And it's ultimately embodied most clearly in the life of David, the priest king of Israel, whose priestly status is in the line of Judah. I mean, he's working as a priest, but he's in the line of Judah. That doesn't connect. And it's a signal that the ultimate coming king priest will have a priesthood that's not connected to the Levitical line. So let's consider Samuel's life. Look at 2:21 with me. Indeed, the Lord visited Hannah. She conceived and bore three sons and two daughters, and the young man Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. Verse 26. Now, in the midst of all this chaos at the central sanctuary and the rebellion and wickedness of Eli's sons, now the young man Samuel continued to grow, both in stature and in favor with Yahweh, and also with man. That should remind you of something that was said of Jesus. Consider chapter 3, verse 19. And Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, from the very northern part to the very southern part, knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of Yahweh. How did the chapter begin? The young man Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli. The word of the Lord was rare in those days. There were not many prophetic visions. God wasn't speaking in those days. People weren't connected to him. Eli was deaf. Samuel. Yes, Eli. Oh, third time. Maybe it's the Lord. And so we read in verse 21, and the Lord appeared at Shiloh, for the Lord appeared himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of Yahweh, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. He is priest. He is prophet. The word of the Lord is now coming to him, and he is recognized as a prophet of God. What does God tell Samuel in this dialogue? Eli's house is going down. And that's exactly what happens. Here's a shot of modern-day Shiloh. Somewhere up there, the tabernacle used to rest. But as you know, it left Shiloh in 1 Samuel chapter 4. The word had gone out. Centuries now after Rahab, after the Gibeonites testified to the great work of God at the Exodus, now it's the Philistines. And Hophni and Phinehas think they've got a rabbit's foot in their pocket, and they bring out the Ark of the Covenant. God is among us. We'll beat the Philistines as they try to encroach into our western border. And the Philistines freak out. Why has the Lord defeated us to, oh, sorry. Let us bring the Ark. Then verse 7, here it is. The Philistines were afraid, for they said, a God has come into the camp. And they said, woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves this day to the Hebrews. So this begins the journey. And as you know, the ark is going to get captured by the Philistines and taken to the Philistine city. Where does it go first? Ashdod. But before we get there, look with me at the end of chapter 4. The ark leaves, the Philistines kill Hophni and Phinehas. And the word comes back to Eli, who is waiting next to the gate of the tabernacle. Verse 18, as soon as the messenger mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate. His neck was broken and he died, for the man was old and honorable. The man was old and glorious, and that's why he fell over backwards and died. That's the same word, heavy. Those who honor me, those who display my heaviness, I will display as heavy. But those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. You honor your sons. You make heavy your sons more than you make heavy me. He fell over backwards and died because he was heavy. Why? Because he was fattening himself, honoring his sons more than he was honoring God. And what you revere, you will resemble, whether for restoration or for ruin. And it destroyed him. So we read, Phinehas' wife learns, your husband is dead. She immediately goes into birth mode. The baby comes early, and it's going to take the life of the mother. Don't be afraid. You've borne a son. but she did not answer or pay attention. She named him Ikavod. No glory. She recognized the Ark of Yahweh as a symbol of his glory, and it's gone. No glory. Saying the glory has departed from Israel. Oh, yes, it has. The Ark of God has been captured because of her father-in-law and her husband. She's despondent. She says, the glory has departed because the Ark of God was captured. No glory. So that glory heads over to the Philistines. And all of a sudden, you remember the story, they set up the ark in the temple of Dagon, the god of grain, and Dagon falls on his face, the idol falls down on his face before the ground, using the exact same Hebrew phrase that we're going to see of Goliath in chapter 17, fell down on his face before the Ark of the Covenant, broken. And then it says in verse 6, the hand of Yahweh was heavy. There it is. You want glory? Okay, I'll give you glory. And that glory weighed them down and brought plague into the land. Get it away from us. So they took the ark away. Verse 9 says, the hand of the Lord was against the city. And so it goes to Ekron. And everything goes bad there as well. At the end of verse 11, the hand of God was heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So at this point, the Philistines are saying, okay, we need to get rid of this glory. We need to get rid of this ark. It's doing us no good. Now notice what it says in verse 5. You must make images of your tumors and the images of your mice that have ravaged the land and give glory to God. The Israelites did not give God glory, and he humbled them. The Philistines have an encounter with glory, and now they actually call the people, give God glory, give God glory. This kind of a God we can't touch. He's just wiped out our chief deity, Dagon. Everything has gone bad since Yahweh came into town. Get rid of his throne. Give God glory. Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? Now, what you miss by that hardened verb, most of the time, this is not the verb that shows up in Exodus, but it does show up one time. Rather than, and it's rendered as hardened, but literally, it's heavy. Pharaoh made his heart heavy. And it uses that language here. Why should you make heavy your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh made heavy their hearts? Again, the wordplay working its way out. Don't be like Eli, who made himself glorious. No, give glory to God. The Philistines have it right. Oh, that the reader would get it. Take the holiness of God seriously. Don't take sin lightly. It will find you out. So put the ark on a cart, put these tumors and mice, little trinkets into there, and let the cart go. And if it goes back to Israel, then we'll know this is from God. If it doesn't go back to Israel on its own accord, then we'll know this was all coincidence. And sure enough, it goes right back to Israel. And then what's at stake is this. Verse 19, the men of Beth Shemesh came, and they looked upon the ark of the Lord, and the Lord struck 70 men of them, and people mourned because Yahweh had struck the people with a great blow. The Israelites at Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before this holy God? Finally, Israel recognizes what they should have recognized in the beginning. It's what Hannah recognized. Those who honor me, I will honor. Those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. They recognize the holiness of God, and immediately then God raises up Samuel as the instrumental judge who then leads Israel to fight the Philistines. He's not just priest and prophet. Samuel becomes judge very clearly in chapter 7. And that sets us up for the people wanting a judge to judge them like the nations, and Samuel himself feeling like they've rejected him because he just led them into victory over the Philistines. But it all happens because they finally understand the holiness of God. That's how the book starts. And then the rest of the story unloads, and it gives us the lens for just understanding. We're just looking at every stage. Are they honoring God? If they are, we know God's going to lift them up. Are they dishonoring God? Then we know God's going to bring them down. So the people do come, and they want a king. And I'm looking at myself at page 2 with 7 pages of notes and thinking, wow, I got a lot to do. So they want a king, it says, to judge them like the nations. Verse 5, behold, you're old. Your sons don't walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. But it displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to Yahweh, and Yahweh said, obey the voice of this people. Give them what they want. For they are not rejecting you, but rejecting me as king. Yahweh was never supposed to be replaced, merely represented. And what the rest of the story here makes clear, in fact, there's even going to be a play on words. God gives the people Saul for their sake. Give them a king for themselves. Whereas David will be chosen for God's sake. But when it says that God chose Saul, it does so in the midst of this significant, ironic context of God giving the people the kind of king they wanted. Chapter 10, verse 19, look with me there. What kind of king? Today you've rejected your God who saves you from all your calamities and your distresses, and you've said to him, set a king over us. They've rejected their protector. But not only that, chapter 12, 17 says this, is it not wheat harvest today? I'll call upon the Lord that he may send thunder and rain, and you shall know and see that your wickedness is great. I'm going to destroy the wheat harvest and show that you're rejecting your provider. Those are our two P's. And in the way that Samuel talks to the people in relation to what they've done in rejecting Yahweh as king, he identifies first, you've rejected your protector, and then you've rejected your provider. But he does say this. Look at verse 14 of chapter 12. If you'll fear Yahweh and serve him and obey his voice, if you'll listen to his voice, hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God, Yahweh is one, love him with all. If you'll listen, if you'll hear, God didn't give Israel ears to hear. Moses says in Deuteronomy 29:4, you're stubborn and you'll remain stubborn into the land. Nevertheless, the principle stands. If you will fear the Lord, what does the Lord require of you? That you would fear the Lord, that you would walk in his ways, that you would serve him, that you would love him, that you'd obey his voice. Deuteronomy 10, 12, and 13. If you'll fear the Lord and serve him and listen to his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, if you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you do not obey the voice of Yahweh, but rebel against the commandment, then know this, the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. Judgment will come. Everything about the success of the king and the kingdom was dependent on this wholehearted Deuteronomic call to love. So God gives a donkey pursuer the kingdom. He looks like a king. He's a head taller than everybody. And all of a sudden, under one man are all 12 tribes of Israel. He's got the kingdom. And as the enemies rise, he goes up against them. Among those enemies are Nahash, chapter 11. Nahash is the king of the Ammonites. And what is important to see is that Nahash is the Hebrew word for serpent. And in this book, I do not think that is by chance. His first battle is against the serpent king. And what's amazing is that Saul defeats the serpent king. Naturally, this is supposed to remind us of what the ultimate deliverer would do. Saul wins. So all the people went to Gilgal, verse 15 of chapter 11, and they made Saul the king there. Before Yahweh at Gilgal, all of Israel rejoiced greatly. The serpent slayer has come. No, because directly after this, we get Saul's fall narrative. So there's something in the book. He battles against the serpent king and wins, but immediately we read the story of Saul's failure, his disobedience to Samuel's voice, and the downfall of his kingdom. So it is that we come to chapter 13, verse 14. We read this, "Now your kingdom shall not continue, you foolish man. Yahweh has sought for himself a man according to his own heart. And Yahweh has commanded him to be priest, prince over his people, because you've not kept what Yahweh commanded you." I think it's very intentional that he defeats the serpent and immediately we're told he's not the Messiah. His kingdom will not last. He wasn't the ultimate priest king. He wasn't in the line of Judah. And he's disobedient. It moves us into the next section of the book. And that is the rise of David, the fall of David, and the hope for someone better than David.
Thank you for listening to this message from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter their content in any way without written permission from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. For more writings, sermons, and lectures from Dr. DeRoshi, please visit www.jasonderoshi.com. Proclaiming the kingdom and treasuring the God who reigns, saves, and satisfies through covenant for his glory in Christ.